Well, I do want to move to analysis with our guest, and joining me first on the telephone is Alan Hirsch. Alan Hirsch is a lecturer in humanities, chair of justice and law studies at Williams College, and author of the book Impeaching the President, Past, Present, and Future. Alan Hirsch, it is very good to chat with you again.
My pleasure.
Let me just ask you, generally, what stood out to you today and what stands out to you where we are in this impeachment trial?
Well, a couple of things. I think hearing Ken Starr claim that impeachment is used too freely was a surreal moment.
Did he even say, how did we get here?
it's really remarkable. I think that the Republicans made a lot of arguments today, some more convincing than others, but they just notes I jotted. They argued at different points that the president withheld aid because of other reasons, such as countries not paying their fair share of foreign aid, his general wariness of foreign aid, and nothing to do with the Biden, certainly, and not even corruption. But then at other points, they said it was because of corruption, but corruption more broadly, not corruption pertaining to the Biden. At other points, the one or more of the attorneys said it was because of the Bidens, but that's fine. At the one argument they didn't make is the one argument you hear some people urging them to fall back on, which is it's not fine, it was wrong, but it's not impeachable. And apparently Alan Dershowitz, I don't know that he'll concede that the conduct was wrong, but he will say that even if it was wrong, it's not impeachable. And then there's also the argument floating around that even if it's impeachable under other circumstances, not in an election year. And I guess my feeling is there's nothing wrong with arguing in the alternative. Lawyers do it in courtrooms all over the country every day. However, none of these arguments is particularly strong. I thought the only argument they were strong on came later in the day, and that was that Hunter Biden and Burisma doesn't pass the smell test. He got the job because of his last name, not his qualifications. That's nepotism. There was an appearance of conflict of interest with his father dealing with Ukrainian corruption. I think all that's true. Whether it's really relevant is another question.
I thought Pam Bondi was pretty effective.
In the sense, I mean, it's shooting fish in a barrel, right? To say that there's something problematic about the vice president's son, who has no particular expertise in the area, getting this lucrative position, to say that that's wrong, it's an easy argument to make. I'm not really sure there's anyone, with the possible exception of Joe Biden, who denies that there's something wrong about that. But is that what bothered President Trump, who has really protested against corruption almost nowhere else, and who very specifically said he wanted them to look into the Bidens at a time which was sensitive? I don't know. I think it's borderline relevant.
Borderline relevant. Okay, that's interesting, yeah.
I do think so. I mean, I think insofar as the president's defense is I really was interested in corruption, legitimate corruption, not because it was a political opponent, and just because it's the son of a political opponent, that doesn't mean you're immunized from investigation. Since that was his defense, I wasn't trying to benefit personally. This was the United States' legitimate concern about corruption in the Ukraine. I think that Hunter Biden's situation is relevant. I mean, I'm not sure it's an argument in good faith, but I think that it's relevant. And I personally would not have a problem with the Democrats trading Hunter Biden for Bolton effectively. And you asked, how do I feel about where things are at? Obviously, everything that happened today is taking place under the cloud of the revelations in the New York Times about John Bolton. And I would say that the Bolton situation surpasses in significance anything we saw today.
Okay.
The real issue on the table now is, will we hear from witnesses? And the odds of that have increased because of the revelations that Bolton confirmed what we really already knew, but it's important where it comes from. And he says that the president told him, the direct evidence told him, that the aid was being withheld pending investigations of the Bidens.
All right. We're going to get into the John Bolton situation. We even have some tape of what Republicans are saying about it. But before we get there, I want to just unpack this issue of relevancy a little bit more, and also how it would pertain to what the charge is against Donald Trump of doing this investigation to try to force Ukraine to announce. And again, I think it's important to say what I think mostly we know is that Trump and Giuliani wanted the announcement of an investigation.
Right.
Unclear if they actually wanted the investigation itself. And that was even testified by several people during the House impeachment inquiry. But let's say it was a legitimate issue to investigate the Bidens. Would it would it be proper to withhold military aid that had been already appropriated by Congress if they didn't do that investigation?
So technically, the GAO has said no. It's not, they just really didn't have that authority to deny the aid. But that feels like a technical question, not a matter to remove a president over. So my answer is, in the realm of impeachment, it really comes down to why did he do it? Was this pursuing the United States interest, balancing different legitimate interests, getting aid to an ally that was in a war versus having that ally be free of corruption? And you know, presidents are expected to balance those sorts of things. Versus, you know, you could say there's a colorable case of wrongdoing over there, but that could have been investigated by the Justice Department. It hadn't been. And why are you suddenly asking a foreign country, making that the quid pro quo? And if the motive is corrupt, if the reason was putting his personal political interest ahead of the national interest, it seems to me that's like the poster child for corruption.
Again, Alan Hirsch, you are the author of the book Impeaching the President, Past, Present, and Future, in which you write about really four impeachment cases, including, even before he was impeached, the possibility of impeaching Donald Trump. You included in there Richard Nixon, even though he never had a Senate trial because he had resigned before he was even impeached by the House of Representatives. So we don't have a lot of precedents when it comes to a Senate trial. This is only the third one in history. The first one was Andrew Johnson in 1868. The second one was Bill Clinton in 1999. What does it look like? And if we do have witnesses in this trial, what do you think that looks like?
Right. So we're really writing on close to a blank slate because the Constitution says next to nothing about what the trial will look like. And we have, as you indicated, extremely limited precedent. We have one full trial in 1868. So that's precedent that's 150 years old. And then we have the Clinton trial. And so there it is. We can must we slavishly imitate the Clinton trial? But what it looked like there was exactly what we're seeing so far, presentations by the two sides, and then what I believe will follow, which was questions the senators could pose, which would be read by the Chief Justice. And then we have the vote on witnesses. And that is exactly what happened in the Clinton case. But what happened there is they agreed to witnesses who would only be deposed, and then the two sides were free to use portions of the deposition through video, and that's exactly what they did. Personally, I think any lawyer would tell you that having the witnesses in front of you, live witnesses, is preferable to a deposition. There's nothing wrong with having the deposition first, so that each side gets a preview and they can do their homework and they can make sure they're prepared to question in the live testimony. But it would be nice to have the live testimony. We don't know at this point whether we're going to have anything, although certainly the needle moved last night. The revelations about John Bolton, it seems to me we went from a position where the good bet was there would be no witnesses to a reasonable chance that there will at least be deposition of witnesses, and then we'll take it from there. I'm told that this is not personal information. This is out there on the web being rumored that Senator Pat Toomey and Mitt Romney are contemplating proposing a one-for-one witness exchange. The Democrats can have their witnesses, but for each one they get, the Republicans or the president, his team gets to call one witness. And truthfully, that sounds pretty reasonable.
Well, Pat Toomey could be that fourth vote, if that's true.
Exactly.
And then that's what they need. We've heard openness, and today even, by Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, and Mitt Romney. Pat Toomey was the name I hadn't heard until you just brought it up right now for being out there. So that would be four votes. I have to tell you, coming into today, I wasn't entirely sure what we were going to hear and how the Republicans were going to address the issue and the news about John Bolton's memoir. The defense team in the trial never brought it up, but I wasn't sure how the Republicans were going to respond. And I saw it actually within the realm of possibility, though this isn't what's happening. We'll hear kind of like what most Republicans are saying in a moment. But I thought it was in the realm of possibilities that Republicans might say, okay, sure, we'll have John Bolton come in. It'll be a classified setting, so it'll be closed to the public. We'll get to the bottom of it, and that will be that, right? But we're not even getting that. And just to give an example, now this is not a senator, but this is Doug Collins, who is the ranking Republican on the House Judiciary Committee.
We are seeing a rerun of what we saw in the House. When the House managers came over, they presented a case in which they didn't do their job. That's been proven forward. And what we also have seen a rerun of is selective leaks. When you only talk about the things that you want to talk about, but you leave out certain facts, you start losing the American people. I want you to focus on one thing. Do not get distracted by the shiny objects of saying we need witnesses or Bolton's new manuscript or anything else. Don't lose fact of the side of the fact that the facts haven't changed. The facts are that the president and Mr. Zelensky both said there was no pressure. There was no conditionality. They got the aid. The aspects of where we were at before September 30th, the Ukrainian people know that the president had their back. When we start looking at this case, we start understanding that this is a rehash of simply a political impeachment that was started in the House and now continuing in the Senate, and the president's team is doing a great job knocking down what is a political impeachment. My concern for all of you should be, where does this leave us? Have we so lowered the bar of impeachment to where political disagreements among staff when the president makes a decision has become the bar for impeachment? That's wrong. And the Democrats have made their case to the American people, and frankly, they have failed.
And that's Doug Collins. And of course, he's in the House of Representatives, the ranking Republican on the House Judiciary Committee. Let's actually also hear a senator. And I'm going to play this from Ted Cruz, a Republican from Texas, because Ted Cruz, at least previously, while he has not said he supported having Democrats desired witnesses participate, he was interested in having witnesses in order to hear from Hunter Biden. Let's hear what Ted Cruz said just moments ago after the break.
This afternoon was devastating for the House managers. For the first time in the entire proceeding, we have heard just the beginning of the serious evidence of corruption involving Burisma, the Ukrainian natural gas company that paid Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son, $1 million a year. Let me answer the question without interrupting me, please.
You got it.
Burisma paid Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son, $1 million a year, while Hunter Biden threatened Ukraine to withhold $1 billion in aid unless and until they fired the prosecutor investigating his son. Joe Biden is Vice President of the United States, and we just saw a video, which I would encourage every news outlet here to actually show the video of Joe Biden bragging how he told the president of Ukraine that he was going to cut off $1 billion, he was going to block $1 billion in foreign aid to Ukraine unless they fired the prosecutor. And in Joe Biden's own words, son of a bitch, they fired the guy.
So why not have Bolton testify? You said you'd answer the question.
I get that the press loves to obsess over the latest bombshell. Listen, I don't know what John Bolton's book says or doesn't say. I've seen the New York Times coverage, but at the end of the day, it doesn't impact the legal issue before this Senate. The legal issue before this Senate is whether a president has the authority to investigate corruption. So the House managers built their entire case on the proposition that investigating Burisma corruption, investigating the Bidens for corruption, was baseless and a sham. Hold on, let me finish this. I'm going to finish my point, and then I'm happy to answer your question. The House managers based their entire case on the proposition that investigating corruption for Burisma and concerning the Bidens was baseless and a sham. That proposition is absurd. We've just seen, they said there wasn't a shred of evidence concerning corruption. We've just seen 2 hours of evidence. And at a minimum, it was not only reasonable, and justified. But the president, I think, had an obligation to investigate corruption that potentially extended to the very highest levels of government.
Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. Before that, we heard from Republican Representative Doug Collins of Georgia. This is our live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. They are in a dinner break as we are speaking, and joining us on the phone is Alan Hirsch. He's a lecturer in humanities, chair of justice and law studies at Williams College, and author of the book Impeaching the President, Past, Present, and Future. So, Alan Hirsch, I guess, and listening to Ted Cruz there, we don't know what they're going to say when we put it on air. We're just sort of grabbing them and turning them around as quickly as we can. Sort of sidestep the issue concerning Bolton.
Yeah, going back to Representative Collins, it was ironic that he complains about selective leaks when the Republicans have it in their power to get the witnesses before them. And Cruz complains that the media obsesses over the latest bombshell. That's close to a direct quote. Again, we don't need the bombshell. We don't need the leaks. Get John Bolton in front of him and hear what he has to say. Senator Cruz, I mean, I thought that was masterful misdirection. He has everyone looking at the potential corruption involving Hunter Biden, which I have conceded is potentially relevant. But it's superseded if it wasn't the reason that President Trump withheld the aid. If it wasn't his legitimate concern about corruption, but rather his illegitimate concern about his potential political opponent. And, you know, Senator Cruz finds himself doing the heavy lifting for Trump. Isn't this whole thing ironic that the whole thing starts very likely, according to the Democrats, there's a fair amount of evidence to support it. It starts because President Trump is trying to tarnish his rival with this guilt by association with respect to what his son was doing. And now that's what Senator Cruz thinks is the only issue before us. It's Hunter Biden and therefore Joe Biden. And he has just become, I don't want to use pejorative language, but sort of the president's water boy.
It might be a little more legitimate if he was equally as concerned in both issues.
Yeah, exactly. I really don't have a problem with people complaining about the nepotism that led to Hunter Biden being hired by Burisma. I don't think there's any evidence that there was actually any wrongdoing by either Hunter or Joe Biden, but I'm totally open to the idea. It is weird, I'd say, that the Barr-led Justice Department didn't see fit to investigate that, and that the president didn't ask his attorney general to investigate that. Instead, he asked a foreign country to investigate it and withheld military aid until they did, or until they would announce that they intended to. So I think there's a lot of smoke that has been put out there to try to keep us from seeing what really matters here. But again, that doesn't mean, in my eyes, that Hunter Biden shouldn't be called to testify. I don't see what the Democrats have to hide.
So again, this is the third Senate impeachment trial of a president, but not the first Senate impeachment trial altogether. There have been a number, maybe a dozen or so, of Senate judiciary.
A couple dozen of
judges and maybe other officers. Do they usually have witnesses? Did you do any investigation into other impeachment cases outside of the presidency?
I mean, I focused on the presidency, but I'm somewhat conversant with the impeachment trials of judges. And as you said, it is mostly judges who have been impeached. And I am under the impression that without exception, they have had witnesses. That's it, counting the Clinton trial as having had witnesses when, again, they had depositions and snippets of that shown. So I think it would be, my understanding is it would be unprecedented if there were no witnesses at this trial.
It's interesting to think about impeachment of judges then, or mostly judges anyways. My understanding, and if this isn't fully accurate, I think it's close to the truth, is that almost every judge who has been impeached has also been convicted by the Senate. It's when we get to... am I wrong on that?
There have been some acquittals, a reasonable number. I think it's been mixed. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me.
Okay, so I was wondering if it was as contentious as the presidential one, with three presidential Senate impeachment trials. If Donald Trump is not convicted and removed from office here, which most people don't anticipate that he will be, then we'll have three presidential impeachments. None of them have ever actually removed from the president from office. Is that telling? Does that say something about impeachment in and of itself?
Well, I think what it says is it does tend to be a somewhat political process. So it is only going to happen when you have an extremely unpopular president. Bill Clinton was not that president. Donald Trump is underwater in the polling, but he's still very popular among Republicans. Andrew Johnson, even though he was unpopular, survived by the skin of his teeth. So I think that's the reality. To go back to your point about judges, people might be wondering why so many judges and so few presidents. With judges, they have lifetime tenure. And the Constitution says they serve in times of good behavior, which basically means unless they're impeached. So that is literally the only way of keeping a judge from serving till his dying breath. And obviously with presidents, you do have elections, and then you have term limits. So there is that saving grace. And Republicans have argued that point here, and I make that point in my book. There is a lot to be said for letting the voters do the impeaching if they want to. I think a real problem with applying that argument to this case is that precisely what the president has been accused of doing is wrongdoing. Is election interference.
Yeah.
And it seems to me not a frivolous concern that if he is acquitted, he will conclude that he can get away with it again.
Before we let you go, I want to turn back to Ken Starr. I found his words today pretty interesting, and I followed them closely. And he mostly made, probably a little more than this, but the three arguments I really zoomed in on are: one, there was no charge of a crime; two, it can't be a partisan affair in order to have an impeachment; you need 2/3, and that's purposeful; and three, protecting the office from just every single subpoena that's thrown at you, protecting the integrity of the office. Going back to there is actually no charge of a crime, his argument I found interesting because it acknowledged what is a reality for me, and that is every constitutional scholar I have talked to said that there doesn't have to be an actual violation or a crime committed in order to meet the thresholds of high crimes and misdemeanors. But he says this isn't being done in the academic setting. It's not being done at the university. This is at the level of the Senate, and we are politically determining now whether or not to remove a president who won the Electoral College, so is in that position, from office. And that he was trying to make the argument there should be a crime connected to this impeachment case.
So let's ask Mr. Starr, what if the president went on a drunken spree for 2 years and just neglected all his duties? What if he pardoned every single member of the Republican Party who'd been convicted of a crime all over America? Just to pick two examples, I could give you 100 if we had more time. Neither of those involve a crime. Does it even pass the giggle test to say that a president couldn't be impeached under those circumstances? And by the way, you know who else agreed with me about this until recently? Alan Dershowitz.
Yeah.
Who said the same thing when Bill Clinton was impeached. Of course it doesn't have to be a crime. And now has decided, along with Ken Starr and virtually no one else, because of reasons of logic, history, and precedent, everything points to the common sense position that you do not have to violate a criminal statute to have committed an impeachable offense. I think some of the other arguments Starr made today were plausible. That one is not.
How about needing a supermajority to impeach, that the framers of the Constitution did not want just a partisan impeachment, hence you have the conviction and removing from office requiring a 2/3 vote in the Senate?
He's right about that. Mm. But then you have to give the House managers the opportunity to build that consensus. And if you're going to say they can't even have witnesses, we're going to have verdict first, trial later, that's certainly not what the founders intended. They did make it so it will be extremely difficult to remove a president. That was wise of them. It will typically require a bipartisan consensus. That was wise of them. But it doesn't mean that you don't initiate the process when you have overwhelming evidence of an impeachable offense, which the Democrats feel they have. And you know, you should have a legitimate trial to determine whether they're right in the eyes of the jurors.
And finally, protecting the office for future presidents, as past presidents have protected the office from not necessarily giving Congress every single thing it wants every time it asks for it.
I think that the second article of impeachment, obstruction of Congress, is a little bit tenuous. And I am open to the argument that they move too fast, that you had an inter-branch dispute between the president and Congress. It should have gone to the courts. Now, of course, the president's lawyers in the courts were arguing that this was non-justiciable, that is to say the courts have no role in it. So there's some hypocrisy on their part in making this argument. But I think the argument itself has some merit. I think the first article of impeachment about abuse of power is the stronger of the two.
Alan Hirsch is a lecturer in humanities, chair of justice and law studies at Williams College, author of the book Impeaching the President, Past, Present, and Future. Alan Hirsch, as always, I'm incredibly appreciative of your time. Thank you.
And thank you.